This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The newest Disney movie, A Wrinkle in Time, brings Madeleine L'Engle's 1962 sci-fi novel to the big screen with some twists. The protagonist is played by a young black girl, and the three magical beings, Mindy Kaling, Reese Witherspoon, and Oprah.
Your father has accomplished something extraordinary. Also dangerous. He's trapped by a darkness that's actively spreading throughout the universe. And the only one who can stop it is you. Be a warrior.
I'll try.
The film A Wrinkle in Time is directed by Ava DuVernay, who is now the first African-American woman at the helm of a movie with a more than $100 million budget. It's gotten some mixed reviews so far, but is it still a success? One of the many topics that we will talk about today on Back Channel, our series connecting culture and context. Later, we'll talk about a new album from Michelle Indigeocello and new efforts to tell stories of women whose legacies have long been in the shadows. Much, much more as well. Joining me now, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thank you, Frank.
And Mark Anthony Neal, chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University and author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Hello, Mark.
What's up, Frank?
You've seen the movie. Tell us about it. This is a remarkable film. The novel itself, written by a woman, a sci-fi novel in 1962 about a girl who goes on a quest, and Albert Einstein is in the shadows. I mean, the theory of relativity is all playing a part of this. Tell us more about the plot.
The first thing you realize is that the film is, you know, it's just simply beautiful. But, you know, you have these two parents who are astrophysicists who are raising these children. One, a young girl who's portrayed by a wonderful African-American actress. And then they have a young son who is adopted at the beginning of the film. And they're trying to figure out how to do time travel without the physicality of it. There's a great scene where, you know, the two parents, Chris Pine, who plays the father, and then I can never pronounce her name. Gugu, right?
Yeah.
Who
yeah.
plays the mom, and they're given a lecture about their theory of the tesser, and literally the folks at NASA are laughing at them. And the film is about the fact that they actually do achieve that. The father disappears for 4 years, and what this daughter does over those 4 years to try to figure out a way to reconnect her family.
Let's play a little bit of that scene right now.
Think about quantum entanglement. Two electrons once bonded together, love, if you will, suddenly separated by a galaxy, but somehow still just as connected. An unbroken union despite being galaxies apart.
And our most recent calculations show us that these fields connect us to other dimensions. Dimensions outside of the limitations of space and time. Imagine that, imagine. Rather than enduring the oppressive rules of time and space, we could wrinkle it. 91 billion light years traveled like that.
That's a scene from the new Disney movie, A Wrinkle in Time, directed by Ava DuVernay. And that movie's gotten some mixed reactions, Natalie. What's your take on the reactions the film has gotten?
Well, I think that, you know, part of it is that it has the potential to be so much. And I think there was a lot of hype, yeah. you know, before it was released. And so expectations were high. And so, you know, I've seen mixed reviews. I've seen people who seem to get that it's a children's movie, right? It's not really for adults. And then those who, you know, have comments and critiques about the writing and not all of the film really coming together. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think as someone who has not seen it yet, because my daughter's schedule has not freed her up to go with me, I look forward to seeing it because I believe in Ava DuVernay.
Yeah.
And I know enough about her. I've read enough about her. I've heard her speak about her vision for her work enough to know that she's about representation. And so what she seems to be trying to do with Wrinkle in Time, as with all of her work, is to show us representations of people that normally we don't get to see. So to have this work, this classic childhood book be reimagined, the story be reimagined with a girl of color at the center of it, I think, you know, Ava did that on purpose, and she wants it to be the sort of thing that girls of color from here on out will know, you know, represents them in a way that they don't usually get to see themselves.
Certainly something that Storm Reid, the young actress who plays the lead, a 14-year-old actress who plays the character Meg in A Wrinkle of Time, and here she is talking about how she pictured Meg when she read the book.
Well, I imagine her as what she was described as a young Caucasian girl with freckles and like wild, crazy hair. So I really didn't see myself being able to be Meg or kind of imagine myself or a girl that looked like me as Meg. But once I did get the script, it kind of all clicked and makes sense. So I'm so glad that we do have a version of Meg who is Caucasian with freckles and big, wild hair, but also people will be able to see themselves in the new Meg that we have.
That's the new Meg, Storm Reid, 14 years old, talking with NPR's Ari Shapiro, who plays Storm plays the young protagonist Meg in A Wrinkle in Time. So, Mark, what are the stakes are high? Because this is not just another Disney movie. We've got all these qualifiers that go with it. First African-American woman, $100 million budget. And it's not, it doesn't look like it's going out of the park. It's right. going to be a good film in terms of its box office. Did Ava DuVernay have to do more than that?
See, you know, it's part of it is a litmus test, right? If you're Ava DuVernay and you're really Hollywood in the way that she is, can you direct a film that's not a quote-unquote black film, right? Mm-hmm. This is not a black film. Mm-hmm. It's a film with a largely black cast, but it's not a black right. film. The challenge was different for Ryan Coogler, right? For Ryan Coogler, it's like, can you sell a black movie to a broad audience? So I think from the filmmaking standpoint, Ava DuVernay achieved what she did, right? Some of the problems with the film, I think, are really script-based, and it's her kind of working through those kinds of dynamics. But again, it's a huge movie that's pitched to children. You know, the thing about the fact that Storm Reid is not a 19-year-old playing a 14-year-old, but she's an actual 14-year-old, right? And you don't forget that in the film, right? It feels like a film that's made for a particular kind of audience. It, you know, it was going to do what it's going to do. I don't think she had to knock it out the park. I don't think that was the point. The point was, could she man efficiently? And bad word there, but could she could she woman a film, right. The film efficiently, get it to market and get it to be able to do what it needed to do, right? It was not going to be Black Panther, right? And I think we would gauge it very differently had it come out before Black Panther. Black Panther has totally changed the stakes. So now everybody wants to do the $1 billion Black right. Panther-like mm-hmm. movie. Wrinkle in Time, even if Ava was able to make the best film possible, was not going to do that kind of work. It just simply doesn't have the bandwidth to attract audiences in that way.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's interesting when you compare it to films of its kind. I mean, take Tomorrowland, for instance. Right, there's a film, Disney film, comes out in 2015, stars George Clooney, has nearly double the budget, $190 million budget compared to $100 million. It did just about as well. And again, you've got a young teenage protagonist on a sci-fi adventure
right.
with no less an actor than George Clooney in the lead. And it did about the same. It came out, you know, on the first week, about $33 million, right. which is about what this did. So it's interesting if you compare it in kind. Ava DuVernay herself talked about her expectations and her hopes for this film.
I mean, I think it's really important that boys be inspired and that Caucasian boys who enjoy a certain privilege in this society see this film and understand what it means to be led by a girl or a person of color. I mean, there's a point in the film where Meg Murray, played by Storm Reid, an African-American girl from Atlanta, Georgia, says to Calvin, her Caucasian friend, "Do you trust me?" It's a moment of great chaos and danger. Usually the boy or the man is saying that to the woman.
Do you trust me?
I trust you.
And he follows her into danger. Just though that image sounds slight, but just the idea that so many people in our culture, myself included, perhaps you, have never seen that. And she's not a Jedi, she's not a superhero. She's just a black girl. I imagine that if some of the guys that I deal with, the men that I deal with in Hollywood, who don't trust my judgment in boardrooms and on sets, could have been a boy who saw that image when they were young, they might even treat me differently.
Ava DuVernay, the director of the Disney movie A Wrinkle in Time, on the NBC Nightly News.
Part of the stakes, I think, also for Ava, with the success of organizations like Black Girls Code, with the success of Hidden Figures, I'm sure there was also an expectation that this film would reach to a broader multicultural audience. a black audience, if you will, in ways that had she not been the director, had all these wonderful women of color not been cast in these roles, it might have been a very different film, and they might not have been able to reach out. I think it's a film that responds to the changing demographics of Hollywood. Numbers that I've heard recently, I mentioned earlier, you know, I was in Los Angeles last night for a conversation about Hollywood and the Black Panther, and my colleague Darnell Hunt, who's a sociologist at UCLA, every year issues a diversity report for Hollywood. And one of the things that comes up is that, you know, 40% of the movie-going audience are people of color. One of the audiences that are actually driving these films in Hollywood are, in fact, Latino audiences, mm-hmm. which is why a film like Coco could do so well, and folks would be surprised that it would do well. But, you know, who's going to see the folks who are going to the movies are going to see these movies, and it's not the same demographic that you might have been looking at 20 years ago.
And we're talking about also, it was one of the critiques in the film, just apart from all of that, was that some of the more idiosyncratic and science-y parts of this film and some of the darker parts of the film were actually kind of Disney-fied, if I may.
It's a Disney film. I mean, there's no way to get around that. You know, one of the things that struck me, though, watching the trailers for the film, because at the same time that we're seeing Hollywood trying to push forward, it's also pushing back to this nostalgic idea of a British American childhood. So when I'm watching trailers for Mary Poppins and when I'm watching trailers for Winnie the Pooh, there seems to be a real kind of disconnect there between the world that we live in and this other part of Hollywood, which is trying to project backwards.
Talking to Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown on this edition of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. And we're doing that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. There's much more to come. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Back Channel today, our recurring series Connecting Culture and Context, with popular culture experts Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Natalie is a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Mark is chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. And we turn now to a new album by artist Michelle Indegeocello. It's called Ventriloquism. It is an 11-track set of covers from the 80s and 90s R&B classics. Mark, tell us more about Michelle.
Michelle Indegeocello, who, you know, marks the 25th anniversary of her very first release, Plantation Lullabies, back in 1993. And she was hard to categorize then. One, because she wasn't quite singing, she wasn't quite rapping. She was pigeonholed very early in her career as a rap act, which is like,
That's crazy.
It's crazy now, given the trajectory of her career. Yeah. She was one of the first artists signed on Madonna's Maverick label, right? So she had a lot of latitude. And she's kind of quietly done it in her way and her style. I mean, even after she left Maverick, you know, 10 years ago, she's been making really these kind of groundbreaking, singular moment albums. So whether we're talking Bitter, you know, in 1999, or Cookie the Anthropological Monkey in 2002, to her album of covers of Nina Simone from 5 years ago, this has kind of been her terrain. And I think she nails it with this album, right? It is a nostalgic look at more 1980s R&B than 1990s, music that has been given short shrift critically and in our kind of historical memory. And she highlights the songwriting craft of many of these songs, their connections to a black community in the 1980s and 1990s, and she breathes new life into them.
Well, in a lot of ways, would you say, Mark, that you're hearing the things in it that you say they may have been underrated as craftspeople? She may have heard it. I mean, I hear it more in her music than sometimes I heard in the original.
There's no question. I think there's stuff that she hears. I mean, she talked about the fact that because she, you know, grew up in D.C., and she always bore witness to these go-go bands doing covers of R&B songs, she found value in trying to find something in the song that she present in her own original way.
And I think, you know, what I love about Michelle, and I've been a fan since she came out with Plantation Lullabies, as Mark said, she's like doggedly herself. Like, right. She is unique. She is absolutely not like anybody else that you're going to hear. And I think, you know, when she first came out, just the fact that she was a queer artist, right, of color, playing the bass.
That's
and,
right. It's
you
a
know,
bass solo
she's
bass
a bass player,
player
right? And as Mark says, she, you know, she sings and she raps. Like, she doesn't quite, you know, she does a little bit of both. And so I think she always has sort of eluded being put into some sort of box, right. And people have tried. But with this album, what I appreciate about it is that it sounds like Michelle. I mean, right. Every right. single song right. sounds like her. And I love it, you know, I love the nostalgia of it, but I also love the creativity because, I mean, she's taking songs like George Clinton's Atomic Dog and redoing them, right. You know, and it yeah. sounds like Michelle.
Well, let's listen to that right here. Down on all fours when you're out there walking the street. They come here, nothing but the dogs in your feet. Down on all fours when you're out there walking the street. Can't compete. Michelle Indeggio, cello's song Atomic Dog, 2017, from her new album Ventriloquism. It seems to me too, Mark, that and Natalie, that the production values, I mean, again, maybe as a bass player who sits back and kind of gathers it all in, right? She's very keen on the arrangement and production, yeah. which really makes her record sing.
You know, she's an ambivalent artist. I know she deals with elements of shyness, so she often doesn't want to put herself out there. But I often find that she's much more comfortable kind of laying low, doing the arrangements, doing some of the production, directing the musicians instead of being out front there. And so the musicality of it stands out, right? This is not, it's an album that's so Michelle, but it's not about Michelle.
Yeah. Right.
Well, and she talks about Prince, too, and the influence that he had on her as a producer, as an artist. Let's listen.
Hearing Prince the first time made me want to make records. Oh, I heard that song, Soft and Wet, and then I went and bought it, and I looked on the record cover, and it said, all instruments played by. And then I was hooked, and then I was just like, all the voices were him, it was everything. It was this one guy who was let loose in the studio, and at that moment, I knew I wanted to make records.
That's Michelle Indeggio, cello. She's talking in a video series for the music news outlet Boombox. That was back in 2014. Mark, your pick for this, you like the album, obviously, but there was one in particular, Ralph Tresvant, Sensitivity. Tell us about that.
So it's the best of the singles that New Edition did when they went solo. Mm-hmm. It's such a great song. And, you know, she takes a song that stood on its own and really presented it in a unique way. Michelle in recent years has had this kind of twangy aspect to her music that's become part of what her sound is. And I kind of joked with myself that the song sounds like something that a lost song from the Footloose soundtrack in 1984, where it sounded like it would be perfectly suited for that movie, right? But they would have never put it in it. Right, yeah.
Well, let's listen to a bit of it.
Someone who will meet you, someone who will
Michelle Indigeo, Indigecello, talking and singing about sensitivity from her new album, Ventriloquism. And Natalie, there she leaves the pronouns as they were for a male vocalist.
Right. I was, you know, I was just thinking about that as I was listening to the song, and I was thinking about it when I first heard the album, because I think she's playing with gender, she's bending it, and I think she's always done that. I mean, mm-hmm. she's always presented as sort of androgynous, but this album, you know, she doesn't change the pronoun. Mm-hmm. She is singing this, you know, in every song, in its original form. And I just want to make this quick note about Atomic Dog. Like, part of why I think it's so kind of, it's funny and it's witty and it's creative that she remakes that is because it is like the height of toxic masculinity, right? This song, right. You know, right. That the Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated uses, and, you know, it's just, it has so much going on with it that is hyper-masculine. And she just really kind of caresses it and nuances, like pulls the nuance out of it in ways that only, I think, a woman would do. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, she's really playing with gender, I think, in really interesting and very, I would say, cutting edge ways. Yeah. You know, she takes risks that a lot of other artists would not.
And she's been doing that all her career. When
absolutely.
You go back to her second album, Peace Beyond Passion, and she covers Bill Withers. Who is he, and what is he to you?
Yeah.
And you don't know who she's addressing
that's
it
right.
to, right? She
right.
could be addressing it to a woman lover. She could be addressing it to
a
male lover.
That's right.
And so the way that she's comfortable in that space, and she's always been very open about the fact that she thinks of herself as bisexual. And I think that's important because a lot of times folks think that that queer artists are hedging their bets by identifying themselves as queer, but this is who Michelle Indigecello mm-hmm. is. Right?
Mm-hmm. And in her public life as well, apart from her music, I mean, she does not shy away from criticizing fellow artists. Well, she's Bruno Mars compared his recent Grammy performance to karaoke. Yeah.
So you know, I know it created a whole debate about Bruno and cultural appropriation. And, you know, this is my thing. You know, Bruno Mars, when all is said and done, is a musically gifted cover artist. And he gives credit to where that is.
Right.
And I think she acknowledged that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you could say the same thing about an artist like Billy Joel, whose all his music is so derivative of other styles of music, but because his musicianship, right,
is so high, he
brings another element to it. You know, no one is afraid that, you know, when we look back at the best of black music 50 years from now, that they're going to be going, oh, it was Bruno Mars. The irony of her making that statement is that the success of someone like Bruno Mars, of course, is another way in which it overshadows this long career that Michelle Indigecello has had making great music.
Right.
Well, talking about women sometimes in the shadows, we can shift gears now to talk about another musician who made a big impact, Roxanne Shanté, and her new biopic, Roxanne, Roxanne, which is streaming on Netflix right now. Tell us, Natalie, tell us her story.
Well, so at the age of 14, Lalita Shanté Gooden, who lived in the Queensbridge projects of Queens, you know, she was like going to do laundry, and the legendary producer Marley Marl called her up to his apartment to, freestyle over the beat to Roxanne by UTFO.
Right.
And, you know, he got it on the radio like the next day. And so she became this sort of, I guess, unlikely, unwitting star overnight. And, you know, it's an important story because in many ways, Roxanne Shanté, you know, is the beginning of a female presence in hip hop. But she doesn't really get her due. You know, she's very much so in the shadows. So for this film, for this Netflix piece to come out now, it's very interesting because it's kind of the Me Too moment, you know, that kind of allows for and ushers it in. But, you know, it's fitting. It's like past due.
It's great because the film gives us a brown sugar moment for her. You know, when did you fall in love
with
hip-hop?
Right.
And we get to see her as a young girl in love with hip hop and battling, like the one kid who always steps to her and she just turns around and she blasts him,
right,
you know, all throughout the film. It's also an important story, right? Her voice mattered because she was 14 and she sounded like she was 7. When she came on the radio, you knew it was Roxanne Shanté. And the film, I think, in its best moments, attempted to tell the story of what it means to be a girl in hip hop in a moment when hip hop didn't make any money, where there was no money in the industry. Right. I mean, she basically retires from hip hop because she could
She's making more money doing
other stuff. Yeah. Yeah. Very different moment than what we think of the world that, say, Rhapsody comes in 25 years later. And it also tries to tell the story of what it means to be a young 14, 15 year old, 16 year old girl on tour with men,
right?
Who, you know, there's no one necessarily there to protect her. Right. When she finally, you know, becomes a mother, she's dealing with the dynamics of managing a career. And in some ways, these are artists who were behind her, producers, who are really eating off of her.
Yep.
And
right.
The thing that was striking to me about the film is that, you know, her beef, you know, the kind of pretend beef with Sparky D,
mm-hmm.
that when stuff hit the fan. Right.
Sparky
about
him.
It was, she was like, that's business.
Right. Right.
This is the real stuff. And I think it was so important to tell that part of the story.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. Because I think that, you know, inherent in hip hop is this spirit of competitiveness. Right. And competition. And I'm going to best you and you're going to best me. And then we're going to have a revenge, you know, and we have these revenge battles back and forth. And, you know, not only the fact that there is a unifying thing about hip hop that I don't think often gets talked about, but between women, you know, the competitiveness that is often highlighted, you know, it's really addressed in a I think a very poignant way, and it's a moment, but it is important that we see them come together and help each other.
And as you said, she's a girl, and her relationship with her mom is critical to this, and plays a very important part. And again, the quick rise in her success, it happened so fast. Let's listen to this clip.
What the hell did you do now? You just can't keep yourself out of trouble, can you?
They've been playing my song on the radio.
What song? So that's where all this rapping shit is going. Okay, well, I like it.
I like it. Roxanne. That's a clip from the biopic that tells the story of hip-hop artist Roxanne Shanté. Actress Shanté Adams plays Roxanne, and actress Nia Long plays Roxanne's mom. So it's got all of that. I mean, there's the fact that she is on her way to do the laundry for her mother when she gets called up to do this record, her first record.
Right? Yeah. Mark and I were talking a little bit before we began that Nia Long is like a revelation in this film, because, you know, we're used to seeing Nia Long in these, you know,
Fresh Prince of Bel-Air,
sultry.
Yeah, very sultry. She's the, you know, the desired girlfriend. Either she's the girlfriend of the cutest guy, or she, you know, somebody wants her to be. And, you know, she is raw in this film in a way that, you know, really said to me, this is what she needed. Like, she just needed the opportunity to really spread her wings and do something different. And she just rises to the occasion. It's amazing.
And that's why someone like Nia Long does a film like this, right? Because it allows her, it's an opportunity for her to really show her acting chops. You know, I watched it. I joke with my wife. It was like, you know, she could have been in Precious.
She could have been Monique's character.
She could have been Monique's character in Precious, the way that she comes off, you know, in the Roxanne.
Yeah.
Well, here she is talking about that role. Again, fresh from her role in Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, here's Nia Long talking about this role.
I had to just get really honest with my own disappointments, with my own dark moments in my life and work from that space to connect with my own self in a way that I hadn't had to for other characters.
That's Nia Long talking in an interview with the Build series about playing the mother of hip-hop prodigy Roxanne Shanté in the new biopic Roxanne. Also, you talked about not being protected. I mean, a young girl on tour, not only not being protected, but abused. And I think the theme of, you know, unreliable men is also critical. Here's a clip later in the film at a time when Roxanne is in the throes of an abusive relationship, and also the industry is not treating her well as well.
Cold Chilling got a deal with Warner Brothers. They don't want to do it without you. They want to push you.
Ray, it's been 4 years and I ain't got no damn album. Tell me why. Because you don't want to pay me.
That's what we're going to do, Shawnee. Get that first album out and then take you out on tour. For real. Look, I'm sorry, Shawnee. That's just how I thought shit was supposed to be. I promise, not this time. We've all learned.
F*** you. F*** rap. I ain't making no money rapping. Really, f*** Roxanne Shanté. Because of her, I'm getting my ass beat every day.
Think about this, Shawnee.
Clip from the biopic Roxanne, Roxanne, that tells the story of Roxanne Shanté. Is this going to change the way we understood and remembered hip-hop, Mark? Recontextualize the story?
I think it means that we have to rethink these narratives about how warm and fuzzy those early days were. The fact that Russell Simmons has been sued in his Me Too moment, you know, speaks to the fact that we're looking at both the boardrooms of hip-hop, early hip-hop, and the everydayness of hip-hop in which women were subject to abuse, right? You know, you can't lose the fact when you hear Shanté Adams in that particular scene, the way that she's talking is because the character's mouth is wired shut because she's been beat by her partner, you know, who was played by Mahershala Ali. Again, speaking to why he would choose a role like this for a small film like this, he obviously brings great character to that character, but it highlights what was going on in the ground. These women in the industry are not protected, right? They're not protected from those who are close to them. They're not protected from those who exploit them and exploit their talents. And I think the main reason why you have to tell a story like Roxanne, Roxanne, because it highlights what that looked like in the early days of hip-hop.
Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown on this edition of Back Channel. There's more to come. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow on Back Channel, talking about a number of efforts to tell the stories of women. I'm here with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. We just spoke about the new biopic about rap prodigy Roxanne Shanté. And, of course, she played a part, that Roxanne Shanté, in the filming of this. So she played an active role. And we were just talking earlier about whether or not we can, you know, recontextualize the history of hip-hop. But you made an important point, Natalie.
Well, you know, Roxanne Shanté is actually one of the executive producers of the film. And I heard her say in an interview recently that the film is really not about hip-hop as much as it is about her life and what it was like to be a young Black girl growing up in the projects at this time. And as Mark was talking about, you know, the lack of protection, you know, that seems to be a run through of Shanté's life, you know, from not having a father figure and the one father figure that she thought she did have, you know, not coming through for them. I won't spoil, you know, I won't do a spoiler alert. But then also all of the abuse that she experienced. And so, it you know, again, I really think that it's a very timely piece to come out at this time when we are really reckoning with what it means to be a woman. And in many ways, you know, especially a woman of color in this society, and how there is a lack of protection. There's been a lack of protection for decades. And now we're kind of, you know, dealing with that fact.
Another moment of reckoning came at the New York Times, a project called Overlooked, an effort to make up for the paper's long history of focusing on mostly white men in its obituary pages. Here is digital editor for the obituaries describing the origin of the series.
This was some feedback we frequently got from our readers. Why don't we see more women and minorities in your pages? And that was something that bothered me personally. So I came across in my day-to-day research a woman who had been credited with bringing tennis to the United States from Bermuda. Her name is Mary Outerbridge. She started the first tennis court on Staten Island, of all places, and I thought, what a neat nugget about history. So I checked to see if we had done an obituary on Mary Outerbridge, and we hadn't. So I kind of tucked that away in the back of my mind. And through my research, I started coming across more and more names like this.
That's Amy Padnani, the digital editor of obituaries at the New York Times, talking with Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman on the story behind Project Overlooked, which is an effort to honor influential women who never appeared, had an obituary in the paper. Natalie, tell me about your reaction to this project.
Well, I love it. And one of the first obituaries that I saw and really surprised me was of Ida B. Wells, because I would have assumed that she would have had a New York Times obit. But, you know, checking out the Overlooked Project, I mean, there's so many women, in particular women of color, who have these amazing stories that we would not know about if this project had not been undertaken. So I think it's a very important project. Again, it's very timely. You know, maybe without the Me Too moment, we wouldn't have an Overlooked.
Yeah, I wonder how much that plays a part in it, Mark, which, you know, it's a dynamic relationship, obviously, but it seems to me that all of these movements are somehow contributing to this opening up the archive and looking back, right?
You know, if you're the New York Times, you're fortunate in that you have an archive to look back on. And for the New York Times in that regard, it's good business, right? It's actually bringing more eyeballs to their product. But I think the combination of the pressure from Me Too and also Black Lives Matter has forced many of these big journalism giants, right, to have to reevaluate their work and their process. The race-related stuff series that the New York Times does email blast on a regular basis to drive readers to race issues that are being covered, the Overlooked series. I mean, I think these are all good contributions to journalism going forward. Hopefully they can bring that same level of attentiveness to the nuances of race and gender and sexuality, ethnicity, and we can go on and on, you know, in their contemporary coverage, even as they kind of celebrate, you know, can celebrate, yeah, we overlooked this, but we actually do have this in the archive and here are these great photos and what have you.
Yeah, it does have to lead to that conversation. I find that it tends to be that way, don't you, in institutions where the awareness of what you overlook starts conversations in any profession about how do we make sure this doesn't happen again. You would hope that, you know, it's interesting, though, that the Times went back into those archives and find out that in its 167 year of the history of the paper, between 15% and 20% of their obituary subjects were women. And in the past 2 years, only a fifth of the subjects of obituaries have been women. So how do you analyze that? I mean, it didn't get much better.
Yeah,
you know?
No, I mean, I think it's, you know, both telling and, excuse me, important that or likely that a woman and a woman of color is the one who brought, you know, even conceived this project. Because I think typically, I mean, even in light of Me Too and Black Lives Matter, I think it really takes a push, and a big push at that, for institutions that are typically white and typically male to even begin to be introspective and start thinking about, well, you know, maybe we could have done that differently. Maybe we could have done that a little better. So it's not surprising to me that, you know, it took an Indian writer, right? I'm assuming, to come up with a project and actually really like flesh it out before it was even considered as something that might be viable for the Times.
A few weeks after Overlooked ran, they did a piece just on Aretha Franklin's birthday on the 24th of their coverage of her performance at the Apollo Theater in 1971. And it was fascinating to me that they actually had covered, right? Because this is a time when New York Times isn't really covering popular culture. But Aretha Franklin is such a figure that they did. And they went back to talk about the fact that they only had two black writers on the staff at the time. Mm. And he happened to be able to get access to Aretha Franklin in her dressing rooms in ways that you know, can't imagine that happening now. So the self-awareness is important. The opening up the archive is important, but the bigger point about, you know, the stories that get told now, what do those newsrooms look like? There has to be people in the newsroom, right, that can say when someone passes, that when some achievement is made, that this is something that we need to pay some attention to.
Right.
And here's why. But I wonder, too, if there's a compounded effect of going back and telling those stories now. I mean, let's say that they had been, those obituaries had appeared. We still may not remember those, some of those individuals. And I'm just thinking about the impact of telling some of those stories today, the stories that we didn't know about, and the impact of hearing those stories and talking about those women now in this moment, in a way that they may have been forgotten had they. I mean, I'm not saying thank goodness we didn't do the obits back then. I'm just saying that it might have that compounded effect.
No, it's good public history work. There's no question about that. Very good public history work.
Yeah. Talking about public history and important history in the United States, we talk about a woman who made a significant impact on history, who passed away on Sunday. Linda Brown Thompson was once at the center of the landmark Supreme Court case Brown versus the Board of Education, and we can hear a clip of her speaking. This is on the 50th anniversary of Brown v. Board of Education decision. This is back in 2004.
To me, the impact of Brown is best seen in the increasing numbers of black professionals today. These are the people that after 1954 were able to have some degree of choice. This surely made a difference in their aspirations and their achievements.
Linda Brown Thompson, the woman at the center of the landmark Supreme Court case Brown versus the Board of Education that desegregated schools. She passed away on Sunday. Tell us more about her legacy, Natalie.
Well, I believe Linda Brown is the young girl that's in, there's an iconic picture of her and her mom on the front steps of the Capitol, I believe. And her mom is holding a newspaper,
Topeka.
The landmark ruling that desegregated schools, so she's that little girl in that picture, and what her family did, I mean, in Topeka, Kansas, but that, you know, reverberated throughout the country, of course, is, you know, just incredible American history. And, you know, I think Linda Brown's story speaks to the sacrifice that black families made, you know, the named ones and the ones that go unnamed that we don't know about. Because they had a vision for something much better that they didn't even necessarily think or know that they would get to see themselves. And I love the fact that there are people like Linda Brown, Ruby Bridges, you know, other women who were young girls during segregated times and who played a part in desegregation, who got to see sort of the fruits of their effort, of the labor of their families and the sacrifices that they made. And so Linda Brown, you know, she's incredibly important in that her family played this role, and it was her family that really, you know, sort of initiated the whole thing.
You know, everyone talks about Brown versus Board of Education, but to put a human face on it, to remember that there was an actual family there whose lives were dramatically affected. Her dad, Oliver, dies 2 years later, and we don't know to what extent that was, just the stress and the trauma of what he did with his wife to carry this case on to make sure that, you know, their children had the opportunities that they had. These are the lost folks of history. You know, sometimes I when I hear millennials talk about themselves kind of being the first woke generation. Well, that's because you got social media to tell folks how woke you are.
right.
You know, these are folks who didn't have access to media except for the black media in very real ways. And everything that we've been able to achieve thus far comes from these unknown, forgotten figures.
That's right.
And Linda Brown has said, you know, it was not an unalloyed sense of glory and achievement. I mean, there were difficult times for her all the way through, and she wasn't always sure she wanted to be, even later on. It was the reluctant prophet in many ways, and that's part of the sacrifice.
Absolutely.
That's the price you have to pay. Yeah. And sadly, you talked about coming to see the fruit of her effort, and also the retrenchment. We've seen resegregation of the schools in recent years, Mark, and we'll start with you and Natalie. I mean, unfortunately, we've lost a lot of ground.
Absolutely.
It has to be for the generation of folks who were on the front lines of those moments in the 1950s. It has to be even more than disheartening for them, you know, tragic in many ways. When you consider the lives and the lives that were impacted, you know, that it's just sad that, you know, that we've seen the erosion that we've seen over the last, you know, hell, in the last 2 years, you know, let alone the last decade.
Oh, yeah, it's been going on for, you know, since, I mean, you can track it from the early 2000s when things really start to go backwards. But, yeah, the past 2 years and actually legislative attempts to create more charter schools that don't offer transportation and some of the things that will clearly resegregate. I mean, there's ways to do charter and ways not. So you can see it legislatively. It's not just an accident. I want to change gears now, though, and talk about the 8-part documentary series on Netflix Netflix about the Flint Police Department. It's called Flint Town, and I want to listen to a clip from one of the documentary's directors, Dre Cooper.
I mean, what's interesting about Flint is that, you know, it's a department that hasn't had, you know, an officer-involved shooting in many, many years. I mean, it's been almost 7 or 8 years. So it's a department that isn't, you know, dealing with, you know, what we have seen over the last few years that's just been jaw-dropping, and right? But that said, it's a department that is so strapped. I mean, the department, you know, is a mirror of the city. I mean, the department is struggling financially. They have fewer officers in Flint for their population than any other city in the country.
Dre Cooper, one of the directors of the new 8-part documentary series Flint Town on Netflix. Series follows the Flint Police Department from 2015 to 2017. Mark, what are your thoughts on the series?
It's an important narrative for us to be able to grapple with. You know, we're in a country now in which infrastructure is failing. When Barack Obama said infrastructure was failing in 2008, he was correct. When Donald Trump campaigned on the idea that infrastructure was failing in 2016, he was correct. What we don't see yet is the political will to really address it. And when you're talking about communities that are largely communities of color and poor white folks, there is no political will to deal with infrastructure in that context. Yeah. So the story of Flint, you know, it embodies it. And we see the same thing now in terms of a water crisis in Kentucky. We see this stuff popping up all throughout the Midwest and other places. We know what that crisis of infrastructure looks like in major urban centers. This documentary allows us to deal with that face to face.
And through the lens of a police department, again, that's a kind of a charged part of your infrastructure. And I think it shows in a much more nuanced way what goes on in those police departments and how they are, whatever else might be going on, part of the infrastructure that is suffering just as much as the water and other utilities.
Yeah, I mean, what I find interesting about this Flint Town series is definitely the perspectives of the police officers, black and white, and the politics. You know, just the deeply entrenched politics that both the department and the city have to navigate and negotiate in order to get anything done. And then at the end of the day, it's the communities that are suffering, you know, and that pay the cost for whatever doesn't get worked out. It's very poignant to watch the series and think about how Flint has, in many ways, in light of the water crisis, been forgotten. I mean, the fact that this is still going on, what, 2-3 years since the crisis began, you know, it's no different than what is happening, continuing to happen in Puerto Rico. It's no different from Hurricane Katrina. It just speaks to the fact that in this country, we really have a hard time dealing with the humanity of people of color and people who are poor. And we often allow them to sort of work their stuff out on their own. It's both disheartening, but it's also eye-opening, very much so.
And it's popular media taking on, politicians don't have the will. It's surprising in some ways that popular media takes on infrastructure and systems like this, right? I mean, it's
absolutely
a dangerous subject.
I mean, I think we're looking at a moment where documentary film is so critical to what has to happen going forward. The access that folks now have to technology to be able to tell the stories easier. The fact that there's so many more platforms. You think about this series, in this Netflix series, where would this have gone 10 years ago?
Right. PBS.
Maybe PBS, right? Maybe HBO, right? So to have so many different options now for platforms and access to the technology, it changes the game and allowing people now to really tell the stories about the lives that they're living.
Yeah.
Mark Anthony Neal, chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University and author and host of the webcast Left of Black. Natalie Bullock Brown, a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. What a pleasure. Thank you both.
Thank you. As always, Frank.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.